David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 397. I'm your host, Steve Raker. Devoid of dinosaur DNA, but known to act in the service of dragons, whether it be their clandestine organization or food service operation. I'm back from over a week of tent camping in the Adirondacks, chopping wood and licking my wounds before the final confrontation with Thanos. Marvel Noise is the semi-monthly podcast proudly sponsored by Nobody. Our scope is all things Marvel, with personally a particular fondness for and fascination with the Bronze Age. You can find, listen to, stream, and download episodes past and present over on MarvelNoise.com, and get new episode announcements, give us feedback, and see images and cover galleries on our Facebook and Twitter pages. You can also find other fine podcasts from our podcasting kingpin of crime, Derek Howard and his Deliberate Noise Network. One of those is our sister show, Indie Comic Book Noise, where the guys, sometimes joined by yours truly, talk groovy indie comics. Guys? What guys? I just hear you yapping into the mic, Steve. Well, this episode I'll be joined by my usual co-conspirators to fully form the Living Tribunal. Whirlwind X, Kevin, and Andrew the L.A. Rabbit will be on. We're going to hit a couple of classic issues of Marvel Team-Up, and also start to uncover one of my longtime comic book blind spots with a 2006 limited series that didn't begin the Agents of Atlas. How's that, you ask? Stay tuned, Mighty Marvelite. Item: the Baltimore Comic-Con is back in 2022 at the Inner Harbor Baltimore Convention Center this October 21st, 22nd, and 23rd. They're a longtime friend of the show, hence all the plugs, and have developed an amazing guest list of comic book creators. The whole thing is one giant-sized artist alley. I plan to be there all 3 days, hanging with my pal and yours, Gentleman Jim Whiting, at his booth full of Fantico and self-published goodies. Come on by and say hi. Get info and tickets at BaltimoreComicCon.com, and see you in Baltimore. And now, a public service announcement. Have you been left out in the cold by your significant other after being bit by a radioactive spider? You didn't ask for that. Feel you're the rightful owner of Captain America's shield? Doesn't seem fair. Having trouble accessing your accounts after returning from the blip and having been thought deceased? Plus, what to do about Tony Stark's estate in Avengers Tower? There are no more Avengers. And that house you bought in Westview before Wanda moved to town that now hangs around your neck like an albatross? There's only one place to turn. No, not Hydra. Not the Kingpin. I mean estate and matrimonial attorney Michael Assoff. A hero's hero for matters both civil and criminal. He'll win the day in the courtroom and knows how to fillet and perfectly cook a steak when he gets home. He negotiated the construction of Avengers Tower. He's so smooth he once stuck Loki with the tab for dinner. Attorney Jennifer Walters says, "Michael's prowess in court makes me green with envy." Lawyer Matt Murdock says, "He's good, but I can't ever see working with him." Michael Assoff, attorney at law. Call him direct, call him collect, but call him today. Or if you're Kang, you can wait till tomorrow. Alright, I'm supposed to give you a recommendation or a review before I get the guys on. Well, I've got one for you. I recently finished watching Shang-Chi, the Master of Kung Fu. And he's a character I always thought was cool enough, but never really bought or read more than a few issues of his original series. Iron Fist was more my martial arts guy in the comics, you know. He fought costumed villains, hung with Luke Cage and the Daughters of the Dragon, while Shang-Chi was more kind of in his own title with only occasional encounters with the other denizens of the Marvel Universe. The comic itself was move to cash in on the kung fu movie craze of the early 70s, and now it's a movie cashing in on the comic book character craze of the 2000s. You can't make this stuff up, true believers. And yet, they pulled it off. Shang-Chi was a very enjoyable flick, in large part thanks to the charisma of the lead characters, who were made to be quite likable and interesting before even anything fantastical happened. Also, the cameo by Wong was cool, and the threat with the giant dragon and everything was really fun. Although, you know, couldn't it have been a Fin Fang Foom design? Come on now, that would have been sweet. The retconning of the Mandarin was clever and entertaining, and story-driven. And Ben Kingsley was awesome to have accepted this follow-up role. Two thumbs up for Shang-Chi. Now, this summer, a new Shang-Chi comic made its debut. Shang-Chi and the Ten Rings, connecting the character to his cinematic counterpart who wields the Ten Rings of the Mandarin, which are depicted as almost like magician linking rings that float around mystically, not, you know, rings on your finger like the Mandarin of the comics. Written by Gene Lung Tang, with art by Marcus To, who thankfully resists the temptation to use more manga stylizations in his artwork. There's just enough to suggest that he knows what he's doing. Here, Shang-Chi has taken over his father's international organization after defeating him by borrowing an interdimensional weapon from, like, the ruler of this other dimensional mystical city, which are the Ten Rings. And when he was done, he returned them, but now they've reappeared, and it's like the cat who came back. He can't get rid of them. Plus, they're super powerful, so now Hydra and AIM and the Hand and a bunch of other baddies are after them. So Shang-Chi is now the protector or safeguard of the Ten Rings. It's kind of a cool new status quo, but it seems like a tough one to maintain beyond an arc or two. But hey, these days 12 issues is a solid run, right? Sheesh. But the premise, pacing, characterization, and art were all solid on this first ish. So I'll continue to take the ride and see where it leads. And I see the guys are ready. Time to bring them in. Okay, here we go, true believers. Andrew's on. And Kevin's here. And after the so far two Kang Fu segments, then those Molecule Man issues, I was kind of thinking it would be fun to give these villain-centric segments a name in the pantheon of Marvel Noise segment names. So I'm going to go with Supervillain Classics, a nod to that one-shot in the early 80s where they collected all the different references to Galactus' origin and put them in one place for the first time. And this time, our Supervillain Classics are also a Bronze Age binge, because we're looking at Marvel Team-Up 19 and 20, both on the Marvel Unlimited, featuring the first appearance of Stegron, the Dinosaur Man.
Wait, Steve, we're not going to go with the villain's voice or something alliterative?
Villain's voice.
Nice. That's too high class for me.
So apparently the comics code didn't have a problem with Kazar here almost putting his knife dagger thing right into the eye of a dinosaur and blood coming off of it. At least it's not red.
It's Marvel Team Up 19 from December 1973 with a Gil Kane Frank Giacoa cover with Spidey and Kazar and the pokey knife. And Len
Wein.
Well,
Wien. It does say Slaughter in the Savage Land.
It's like Slaughter on the cover. Len Wein writes, and Glennis Wein colors. And also interesting in the credits, I thought inker Dave Hunt is the letterer.
This yeah. seems like a regular 70s creative team you would see.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, I'm glad they... I'm reading these on the Unlimited. Glad they put the credits on page one, Steve, but when I see that up nose Gil Kane shot, I know, I am right in business. I love that, man. Ever since I had the Treasury with the Morbius reprints,
yeah,
you know, where Spidey gets the six arms and everything, I've always had a soft spot for that hatched upturned nose.
The opening splash is amazing Kane art. I mean, the pilot in the foreground gets the full foreground treatment, right? He's like fully rendered right down to the seams of his gloves. The issue opens with Spidey jumping out of a plane with no parachute into the Antarctic air over clouds that hide and protect the savage land. Just off he goes, no chute.
Mmm, pancakes.
The part I liked was how he admits he doesn't have a way to get home again.
Like, yeah.
Like, it's not an easy trip to down there, I'm pretty sure. That's not a quick cab ride.
Supplies in general, right? I mean, it seems over superhero-y to kind of jump out of the plane in just the costume. It's like, how about a parka, right? Or a pack with supplies. Like, his mission is to find this evil scientist gone AWOL. Like, is he expecting the guy to feed him too? Yeah. But anyway.
Also, how's he going to get that guy back? It's not just a lift for him, but it's a lift for the whole crew and everything. But Spidey will figure it out. He's got that Parker luck, Steve.
Even just getting the transport there, I mean, it's a S.H.I.E.L.D. plane, so it makes sense. Fury's doing him a favor. And the mission is to find this renegade scientist for Kurt Connors. So Spidey's doing him a favor. The guy is Dr. Vincent Stegron.
Well, that's not ominous.
He's been messing with dinosaur DNA, kind of in the way Connors messed with lizard DNA.
Was he trying to replace his foot or something?
And Spider-Man has previous knowledge of the Savage Land from Amazing Spider-Man 103 and 104, 3 years earlier, which was at the end of 1970, which notably also had art by this creative team of Gil Kane and Frank Giacoa.
I would have liked if he had dragged Kurt down with him too, though. The lizard in the Savage Land seems like a natural pairing of character and setting.
And how does Spider-Man survive? He whips up a web parachute and comments on his insulated costume protecting him from the cold. So this mission to find Stegron is almost cut short right out of the gate when he encounters a pack of raptor-like dinos and eventually, you know, is going to be overwhelmed by them, but Kazar and Zabu show up and save him.
With some real... He likes making Kazar and Zabu particularly savage with these fearsome looks on their faces. There's a lot of great expressions in these ones. Also, Kazar hasn't gone total Tarzan, but he's not totally regular Kevin either. His dialogue kind of flips back and forth, I felt, a little bit.
He's not like me either.
I mean, Kazar's been around since the pulps and those early Marvel comics from, you know, timely days, but here it's still early modern day Kazar, you know?
Still defining the line between how much he's going to be the talk funny man versus the regular guy chit-chatting it up.
Kazar offers to help Spider-Man find Stegron. In fact, he's heard that he's moved in with the Swamp People and declared himself king of the dinosaurs.
That's some good real estate, Steve. I hear property values are really going up.
Just then they're attacked by the Swamp People tribe. You know, they fight hard, but our heroes are taken down and out, even Zabu.
I thought you were going to say they were swamped by them, Steve.
No.
But, I mean, this mission is not going well, right? Like, Spider-Man's basically failed twice already. He was going to be overwhelmed by the dinosaurs, and now they're totally taken out by the Swamp Men.
I like how they brought him to Snake Mountain.
On the other hand, Steve, in 7 pages, he found his dude in the entirety of the Savage Land. So, you know, good on him for at least getting to the target.
I'm thinking by now, probably, though, that insulated suit that protected him from the frigid air, you know, up in the atmosphere is probably feeling like a pretty bad idea now that he's down on the hot jungle floor, right? They get dragged to Stegron's feet in bonds. And, you know, it turns out Connors was right to be worried. This guy just became the lizard version of dinosaurs. And we get the debut of Stegron the Dinosaur Man.
Awesome character design, by the way. Like, not that it doesn't owe some of the ridges and scales to Lizard, but a completely original look because they give him the plates along the spine and a different color scheme. I think it's just really striking visually.
I love the cover of one of those early issues of ROM. Maybe it was like issue, I would guess, like maybe 6 or 7 or 8 or 9, something like that. That's a Michael Golden cover, and it's got Stegron like coming around the corner at ROM, who doesn't see him coming, and that's some good Stegron. So what does Stegron want? He wants to return dinosaurs to what he considers to be their rightful place. First the Savage Land, then the world.
So he's trying to make Jurassic Park.
I guess.
He wants all eras of dinosaurs at the same time, right? Not just Jurassic.
I thought it was going to be more like that Dinosaurs TV show where they have jobs and wear clothes and stuff like that.
Kazar, I mean, does he want them to be intelligent too?
Well,
I mean, are more intelligent?
I think he wants to be the intelligent one.
Well, that's what I was wondering. He wants to rule them.
Speaking of ruling them, Kazar tries to pull rank on the Swamp Men. You know me to be a fair, good guy, right? And they're like, whack. They're not buying it at all. So Kazar has to fight his way free and free Spider-Man, who then frees Zabu, and they manage to escape.
I love it how in every panel, like, the Swamp Men are either evil or, you know, ferocious looking, except the one panel where the tiger gets loose. Yeah. And then they look up. The one thing that
you feel bad for them,
rightly so.
You immediately feel bad for them.
I don't think Zabu's going to web them up, Steve, for the cops to come get them later.
So Stegron boards this giant technological arc platform vehicle thingy hidden in the jungle, which is right where, air quotes, they said it would be.
Looks expensive.
Spidey, Kazar, and Zabu reach him and intercept. So Stegron sends a charging horde of dinos at the Swamp Men's village to cover his escape.
I'm not really sure why he put they in quotes, Steve. Is he ironically calling them they, I guess? That's what we're going to find out. But seems like he could have just said right where they told me it would be.
Well, who is they? They is a mystery. It's comics shorthand for they stands for something. There's a mystery there to be solved.
So it's not them.
Almost. Kazar and Zabu foil the stampede while Spidey takes on Stegron. And Spidey gets knocked off the arc before it takes off. But then he web swings between pterodons flying in the air and managed to hitch a ride on Stegron's platform arc as a stowaway.
Steve, if we can just get every crane operator in New York to turn their cranes, I can... That's what reminded me of that. What was that? Yep. Spider-Man 2 or whatever. Yeah, it's a weird... And boy, that insulated suit is really going to get a workout as he flies from the bottom of the world all the way back to New York.
Yep.
And his arms are probably going to be a little sore, too. Maybe it's really fast. Arc, or is that worse that it goes fast? I don't know.
Marvel Team Up 20 is Spider-Man and the Black Panther with a Gil Kane John Romita cover, but art interiors by our pal Sal Buscema with Frank Giacoa and Mike Esposito inks. And mentioning Spidey's arm, I think this is a great dynamic splash page because Spider-Man's right back arm is posed as if it's kind of blowing backwards in the winds as he takes it off of its last placement and then, I'm guessing, reaches up and sticks it to, like, continue to climb up the side of the arc.
I also love that it shows Stegron gesticulating with his fists and you know the whole way he was ranting the entire flight about how he's gonna get the squishy mammals and dinosaurs are gonna rule everything.
And this whole first Savage Land, then the world, it was like skip the Savage Land, going right for the world. As the arc approaches New York City, I mean, we still really don't know what Stegron intends to do with this whole arc other than rule the world. Like, the specifics have not been mentioned at all. They're still fuzzy.
Well, he's not dumb. That's how they get you, Steve. They get you monologuing, and then that gives the hero time to counter your plan. He's playing seventh dimensional chess here.
Spidey engages Stegron, who hits him with his tail again. And Spidey's like, oh, no, you knocked me off your arc back in the Savage Land with your tail. It's not going to happen again, but it does. Stegron knocks Spidey right off the arc towards certain death in the harbor.
Reminds me of those old, when the Scorpion first came out, it always seemed like he was getting his clock cleaned by the Scorpion's tail.
But to have Spidey be like, you're not going to get me with that tail, whack. Right off. Meanwhile, at Avengers Mansion, Jarvis the Butler alerts the Black Panther to a large lone vessel that's approaching the city. So he goes to check it out and manages a timely rescue of Spidey before he hits the drink.
You know, I never liked Quinjet with a hyphen, Steve. Can I say that?
Yeah.
To me, it's always Quinjet, one word, no hyphen.
Noted. And Spider-Man fills the Panther in on what's going on here, and they agree to team up. But first they got to consult with Kurt Connors, and they use his lab to create new dino-strength webbing with the caveat that it's unstable at best, and the Black Panther's like, you could never use it regularly, but for just this once, it should work. Meanwhile,
I prefer when the art team, sometimes they do the Black Panther where you can see his eyes behind his mask, like in his face. I like that to the, like the white. Here, I know they do both in this one.
Yeah, here they do it for the close-ups they give you, right? If it's close enough, you can see his eyes, but if you pull back, no pupils. While they're in the lab, Doc Kurt Connors' job is to work on an antidote for Stegron, kind of building off of what they had established to cure him of being the lizard, but it turns out it's just not possible. Meanwhile, you've got Stegron stampeding with his dinos through the streets and into Central Park, claiming the island as his own.
Never go into parks in the Marvel Universe, or any usually comic book universe. Never go into the park.
I like that this is his plan, right? He like basically transported the dinos there on the Ark, and now they're going to march around like Godzilla takes Tokyo or something.
Marvel Comics rule, if you control a group of giant monsters, you have to have a staff. Mole Man did it. Stegron had to go get his staff. Like, that's the standard accoutrement.
In the pages that follows, there's a lot of punching. But the new webbing is a hit, right? Does the job. Stegron tries to escape on a flying pterodon, but Spidey hitches a ride. Good old webbing. And Spidey punches Stegron off of the pterodon into the river, where he drowns. Glub, glub.
What?
It's a pretty rough ending.
Yeah.
So, who was the they? Right? The they in air quotes who gave Stegron the flying arc platform thing? They never said, right? Until 5.5 years later, in the summer of 1979, in Incredible Hulk number 241, writer Roger Stern has an organization led by Tyrannus, who's pestering the Hulk, called They Who Wield Power. And, you know, Tyrannus is that subterranean imperial king guy who is always trying to add territory to his kingdom through conquest. And there they retcon that They Who Wield Power had been manipulating heroes and villains by outfitting them with weaponry, including the orb in his first appearance. They gave him the cool, like, laser gun that seemed way more technological than he should have had access to, who had his first appearance in Marvel Team-Up 15. And they also mentioned Stegron's arc here in Marvel Team-Up 19.
Wow.
So that's why it's a they. It's they who wield power.
Well, Steve, as regular listeners know, I'm an old man. And in the old days, it was very catch-as-catch-can your experience and exposure to weird things in the Marvel Universe. And you didn't always have context because there was no Google or internet to look stuff up. So you were exposed to parts of the Marvel Universe and you didn't have any previous reference. So I never read these issues up until promoting this one. But in the late 70s, there was a company, Thought Factory, that released a series of posters. And what they were, I had the Spider-Man one, and it's a large picture of the character Spider-Man. And then at the bottom, they steal a panel from the actual comic books. And the panel this one chose was from Amazing Spider-Man 165, Spidey punching Stegron and saying, "Face it, Steggy, you've been better off sunk at the bottom of the harbor." It brings up the question, how do you survive that little drowning episode anyways? Now, the book has the site, you know, the editor's notes. That wasn't on the poster. So I had no idea who Stegron was. I didn't know what this, you know, what he was referring to or any of this stuff. It was just Spider-Man punching a dinosaur man at the bottom of this giant poster. And then 40 some odd years later, the question is answered by Super Steve saying, "Read these things." And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's what this poster was talking about.
That's
funny. Lifted from the comic book. So it was just one of those funny things about, you don't, you know, you're a kid and you just read stuff or you see posters or you see out of context images. And it was funny. Now I can look all this stuff up. Like, oh, I looked up what issue of ASM it was and all that stuff. But yeah, so it made me funny that you solved an old mystery, Steve.
That's cool. And spoiler, he didn't die, right? But that was actually his next appearance was in Amazing Spider-Man 165. And that wasn't until 3 years later in November of 76. But interestingly, it was also written by Len Wein. And it's the one, if you remember, it's even depicted on the cover, but I certainly remembered it as a kid because it was creepy as heck when I bought it off the racks. And Stegron's got like this ray where he can reanimate the dinosaur skeletons that are in the museum. Yeah. And that's pretty creepy. And then the lizard is like, Kirk Connors is going downhill. And in the second issue of the two-issue arc, it's Spider-Man versus Stegron and the Lizard.
Yeah, I never had those two issues either. So it was just a whole mystery. Who is Stegron? Or as I called him, Steggy.
But yeah, just, cool.
Posters were a lot more prominent. Like, I didn't have, you know, original art or commissions or anything like that, but there were all these weird companies that would spin off and produce random images of stuff. So I remember the Spider-Man one. There were also those series, I think Coca-Cola maybe had it.
Yes.
Or, and there was Spider-Man, yes. Fantastic Four, and Hulk, and they would have
those
bits of a comic book.
A bunch of those were inked by Joe Sinnott, too.
I had
the Fantastic
Four
one.
Because they were just something about you wanted these things. Because, you know, you didn't have necessarily regular fix of your comics from the comic store or whatever. You'd get them at the drugstore, so you have these posters. And they would just fire up your imagination because you got the little, tiniest little taste of what was going on.
And have no fear, faithful listener, how did Stegron survive sinking to the bottom of the the river there, and his explanation is that he reduced his metabolism until he achieved a state of virtual suspended animation and then drifted along with the current until at long last he was swept ashore. But they multiply the S's in all of his speak, so it's like lizardy, and the word ashore looks like a curse. Anyway, so that's Stegron's first and next appearance.
And he's on a poster. If you're interested, there are copies on eBay as we speak.
Nailed flat. All right, Kevin, give us an interlude. You told us about these neat little packages you came across that remind me of the old, like, Whitman samplers that I would buy that were shrink-wrapped packs of comics that you could only see the one and you couldn't see, like, the other ones inside, so you always ended up with some mystery comics that I used to buy when I was a kid.
Yeah, and I feel like they've almost always been around. It's like excess inventory or whatever, or then, like, even in something like a Sears catalog, there would be like, hey, kids, this is the Wish book. Here's a few comics if you order this thing. And you're just like, oh, man. There'd be all these neat comic booky things. And then you'd see that one on the top, and it would be like, I don't know, G.I. Joe or something. You'd be like, oh, it looks cool. And then you look through it, you open it up, and then you're like, yeah, the other ones in there weren't great. It reminds me of some comic stores. They do their own, like, I guess they were the mystery boxes of their time type of thing. Where
my favorite. I was just about to say, the mystery box. One of these boxes has a comic you would want to read. Yeah. We're not going to sell it to anybody, but hey, keep buying all the other ones to get rid of our inventory.
Yep, you'll get a few keychains along the way.
You put something shiny on top, and then you put, like, the guts in the middle and everything. So, I mean, maybe you can see the comic at the back, maybe. But I remember seeing those through the years, and I think at one point I didn't see them really anymore. Maybe around, like, say year 2000 or something, like, I wouldn't really see them around, but yeah, they're definitely still around at different places. So I have one here. All I can see, There's supposed to be 7 comics in here.
7?
And all I can see right now is an alien comic. So I'm going to open this up and see what I get.
Wow.
Come on, AF-15, AF-15, AF-15.
I mean, they should all be...
Like Alien, like, from Dark Horse? Stuff
from, like, the last couple of years.
Oh, okay.
So,
is it a Marvel? Is it advertised as a Marvel pack?
Yeah, what does it say here? Yeah, it just says Marvel Comics.
All right.
And it has, like, some...
I like Marvel Comics.
Spiky type of, like, pow-bam type of symbol around it. So... Oh. This looks like a Star Wars book. War of the Bounty Hunters.
Ah.
Never heard of Star Wars.
So it's funny... They were like 3 packs, but in here, this is a 7 pack, so now I gotta open the other. Because I put one comic on top that you can see. And then the other two are like
I've seen that with like trading cards too, with like sports cards, where they put like one visible one on top.
This is tougher plastic than.
You just damaged your comics.
Yeah, I know.
That's where you need to be friends with Daredevil. He can just feel the plastic and tell you which comics are inside.
From the ink on his fingertips.
Oh, and this looks like Conan Serpent War. And it looks like featuring Solomon Kane and Moon Knight. So this is a second printing of that issue. I don't know if you read that series.
I did.
Super Steve?
How could I not read it if it's going to have Conan and Moon Knight in it?
Well, I'm thinking maybe you didn't bring it up and you're just like, I'm not going to bring this up.
Yeah, no, right. I'm not going to bring it up. I didn't bring it up. You brought it up.
Oh, we have an issue of Avengers here. That was my first pack.
Which event? The Savage Avengers or?
No, just regular Avengers.
Diet Avengers or?
It's the end of the run there with the World War She-Hulk thing.
Oh.
So far, this pack not quite as good as the first pack I opened up. But I think them's a break sometimes.
That's right.
And now I can see that I got another annual from that Infinite Destinies. This looks like Iron Man versus Quantum. Maybe his first appearance?
Hmm.
Oh, nice. That'll be worth something.
Yeah, so this is also one I don't have, so that's good. It also has that Infinite Fury story.
Right.
See if I can. Oh, this plastic's different on this one too. I feel like the other one was the hard plastic, but this one's like tighter.
Gotta get some of those Star Wars books have good turnaround too, with weird first appearances of new characters and everything.
Oh yeah. Let's see what I have here. Oh, what is this? I'm not quite sure what this is. This is a black and white virgin cover of... is this supposed to be Psylocke or Kuonin? Oh, this is a Demon Days X-Men number one variant cover. Black and white. Like it's like a pencil. That's pretty cool. And then I got Thor and Loki Double Trouble variant edition. It's one of those Todd Knock just headshot covers. So that's pretty neat. Also something I didn't have.
Cool.
So I'd say that second pack was definitely the winner out of the bunch there.
Nice.
I might buy more. Who knows? Like it's the thrill of the mystery box, right? You're just like, I wonder what I'm gonna get. And I would say these. I mean, your mileage may vary, but I would say these are better than the old ones where you would be like, oh, that G.I. Joe is cool, and then you look inside and you get DP7 or. You know, some random or a
killing
USA kid or what? I don't know. Some
as a guy that went big on New Universe, you're killing me. But
I'm just thinking, maybe I would be more interested in those now. But back then, I'm like, hey, I wanted Spider-Man or something. You know, I'm not like some random sentient truck roving across the world.
I still haven't read any New Universe stuff. Funny.
Well, it's poised to make a comeback, Steve, and then you'll be sorry.
Yep. All right. I've got a self-admitted blind spot that Kevin's finally getting me to read that isn't New Universe.
You know what's funny about it, though? I feel like the 2000s are the least represented. Like, I haven't done any scientific analysis, I should, of what eras we usually cover, but since the podcast started...
Right.
In that era, I feel like we don't go back to that era, so, like, we do recent stuff...
It's true.
...and we do older stuff, and the 2000s does not fit into either of those categories.
Oh, it's a fair criticism and observation, I would say. It is, just because that's when the show started, so those were the new releases and the Skrull Watch and all that sort of stuff from Secret Invasion and all that business. But yeah, but this is the Agents of Atlas first limited series from 2006. You know, I did, though, as a kid, read What If Number 9.
Oh.
When it came out in 1978, What If the Avengers Had Fought Evil in the 1950s, which was by Roy Thomas and Don Glute, with art by Alan Kupperberg, with inks by Bill Black. And
see, I only think I only ever saw that cover because you'd see some of those things, and then I'd be like, well, that looks interesting. And then the only other time I saw them before the story was in Avengers Forever, when all these realities are being wiped out.
Right.
And one of those variant covers is like a Frank Whiteley of those characters. And oh. I'm like, I was so like interested in those characters.
Huh.
But there's no way you can really see that many further adventures of them. It's right. Just didn't exist.
And that issue of What If was not one of my favorite issues of What If. Because in one reason was it was framed differently. It was there was a framing sequence with the Beast using some doohickey of the Squadron Supremes to view what turned out to be the story, and it was unclear whether he was actually viewing the past of the Marvel Universe, of the 616, or if he was looking into another dimension. And it was in that Avengers Forever issue number 4, that clarified that he was looking at another dimension, and then Immortus destroyed it when he was destroying, you know, other realities, basically. But the gist of that issue is that FBI agent Jimmy Woo assembles a team of the 50s Atlas heroes to be the first Avengers, and they rescue President Eisenhower from the Yellow Claw, and it's 3D Man, Marvel Boy, Gorilla Man, Venus, and the human robot. And at the end, Eisenhower's like, people are going to freak out if they know that all these people have powers and could be such a force like this. So he orders them to disband and classifies the whole event as secret, so no one knows that there was ever an Avengers that formed.
Well, as long as he doesn't run into the 1950s X-Men.
So then you fast forward to 2006, where writer Jeff Parker and artist Leonard Kirk, inks by Chris Justice, they take the idea of this team and they just run with it, right? Like,
yeah.
The first 6 pages of issue 1 recap the Eisenhower rescue adventure from What If Number 9, but now it's in continuity and it's being told, like, as a the memories of Gorilla Man.
Yeah, this is good comics. I just wanted to get that out of the way. Spoilers to anyone that was wondering what the end result, like what the review would be or whatever. This is just good comics. Like, I want to read good comics like this all the time.
Jimmy,
I remember buying the first issue of this off the stands, and then that's the only issue I had. I mean, I don't know if I would have been able to find the second issue if I was like really jazzed. I mean, I enjoyed the first issue enough, but second issue, I guess, wasn't there. And then I don't think like a lot of people were puffing it up and saying, oh yeah, Agents of Atlas, because I don't think the series was ever a massive seller or anything. But I remember after the series came out in hardcover, I'm like, yeah, I got to get that collection. And the hardcover is just a thing of beauty. It's one of those Marvel Premier editions.
Yeah.
And it has all, like, the online material.
Oh, cool.
And then it has, like, all their first appearances of the characters reprinted in the back, too, which is really nice. And some, like, I guess, like, rarely reprinted. Like, I don't know how often, like, Jimmy Woo's first appearance is reprinted and stuff like that. So it's pretty cool. A lot of stuff in here. I would definitely recommend, if you can find this, I don't know, maybe some comic shop still has it on their shelves, or like in a used bookstore or something, if you find this hardcover. Definitely awesome.
These issues are all on the Unlimited, fortunately, too. Jimmy Woo's been a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent all these years since the FBI, and he gathered a like a clandestine team and raided this facility owned by the Atlas Foundation that he was investigating, and everyone on the team gets killed, and Wu is left horribly burned, basically brain dead, and on life support. So they bring in Gorilla Man and question him, but he doesn't seem to know anything. But the next thing you know, he and the human robot, M11, break into the infirmary and take Wu to a tractor beam up to what looks like Marvel Boy's ship. And the issue ends with a younger, very much alive Jimmy Wu emerging from a liquid nutrient bath.
Yeah, that's so weird.
I love that. Sometimes when you have a team that's firing on all cylinders, you can kind of do whatever you want. Because normally I would be like, oh, come on, assembling the team's going to take forever. But because these are characters I'm not super familiar with or whatever, and they really center each one on those characters, kind of each sort of gets a chance to shine, I feel like it works really well in this case.
Yeah.
And that's a tribute to Parker, Kirk, and Justice. And I also feel like Kirk went on to kind of blow up, I think, after this and be a bit more well regarded, is how I remember it. I might have it backwards, but I thought he got to be a pretty big wheel there, more towards the later part of the aughts, or I don't know how we call them, those early 00 decade or whatever.
I resisted the urge to say 00s, and I just said 2000s instead.
Yeah, I think Kirk's work here shows some of what we know him for, but also there you could still tell that there's times where some of his draftsmanship is still inconsistent, and I can't remember.
I love that scene where M11 is holding up Gorilla Man and he's shooting 4 guns.
Oh yeah, oh that's so cool.
It's just like, it's a total like Groot and Rocket type of thing, or it's just some crazy attack maneuver.
And Gorilla Man's like, don't break me now, like, you know, be gentle. Pretty funny. So the second issue has S.H.I.E.L.D. agents Dum Dum Dugan and Derek Kanata piecing together clues. And it's like, who killed Jimmy Woo? What was this case he was working on? And how could that be Marvel Boy? Because he was psycho as the Crusader way back in Fantastic Four 164 and 165 from 1975, written by Roy Thomas.
Yeah, you must have been well aware of them referencing stuff like that.
I bought these issues off the shelf as a 5-year-old and read them for years and years until I lost them in a house fire when I was in 5th grade in 1980. But the way that this appearance of Marvel Boy ended was he became overloaded and burst, like he like spontaneously combusted and disintegrated into ashes, leaving just the quantum wristbands that now Quasar uses. So how could he have been involved in this escape? We also get told the Gorilla Man's origin and how he's a cursed dude and he killed the other Gorilla Man, and if someone kills him, they become the Gorilla Man. So Agent Kanata catches up with Marvel Boy and M11 and Gorilla Man with Wu, and Wu's like, he's super charming and pretty accommodating, really, but he has no memories since the group disbanded back in Eisenhower's day, back in What If number 9, because that's the last time that Marvel Boy knew him and was able to, like, imprint his consciousness and copy it for, you know, a download, basically.
Oh, it's the regular Xavier backing up everyone's minds here.
Well, I know Jeff Parker has talked about and has gone on to do James Bond comics, but I feel this was like his proto run at Jimmy Woo as like a James Bond kind of suave secret agent guy. And so, you know, you write what you want to write, and it works pretty well here.
They reach the outer rim of Wakanda and reunite with Venus, who's lived there helping bring peace to warring tribes for the last, I don't know, 2 decades or so.
I always, when Venus is on there, I'm always looking. I'm like, they're not showing too much. Yeah. Like, you're always, there's always that.
She wears no top, so yeah. her hair has to cover her. Jimmy Woo walks behind some huts and bushes to go drain the dragon, and he gets attacked by the Yellow Claw and these ninja-esque henchmen as the issue ends. In the
next, look at that cover for issue 3, too.
The covers are pretty striking by Tom Coker.
Yeah, I love those.
The Claw is just a robot, actually. But he declares to be behind the whole Atlas Foundation and dares Wu to come and stop him.
And if you're concerned that the Claw is a robot, Steve, I got some bad news about Dum Dum Dugan.
No kidding. I refuse to accept that. Huh? At one point, they're discussing intelligence and go back to the undeveloped aspects of that original What If tale and pose some other interesting questions, like, why did Jimmy Woo pick these characters to make his Avengers team back then? And the answer is, it came to him in a dream. But Namora was the one he dreamt about being on the team, and she declined joining and is the one who offered up M11, the robot, in her place.
I too have a lot of dreams about specific intellectual property and what characters I still maintain the rights to.
And then M11 appeared suddenly to Gorilla Man just before the shield brought him in for questioning. So M11's a real X factor here. They'd like to question Namora as to where M11 came from, but she died. Namor was shown her corpse in Submariner 50 from 1972, which was written and drawn by Wild Bill Everett, the Submariner's creator. The issue also introduced Namora's daughter, Namorita.
Huh. Any connection there?
I really want to reread. I've only read some of those issues, but I want to read that Silver Age into Bronze Age Namor series. There's some good stuff there, some Gene Colan underwater stuff, and Atuma, and the Visor, and all that stuff. It'd be fun.
I want to read that, too.
Ooh. All right. Let me make a note of that. But now M11 is pretty certain that Namora is not dead, and he has the coordinates of where her tomb is. En route, Marvel Boy explains his continuity, and it turns out the colony of Eternals that were living on Uranus was a penal colony. No snickering, Andrew.
I wasn't gonna say anything. I'm a classy guy, Steve.
And this group of Eternals, banished Eternals living on Uranus, outfitted Marvel Boy with his weaponry and outfit and stuff. And the Crusader, who died in Fantastic Four 165, is a Klor. Totally engineered, given memory implants to think he was Marvel Boy, Bob Grayson, the whole thing. That part I really didn't like. That was too much retconning for Steve.
Oh, sure, but if it had been an LMD, Steve, you would have been cool with that, I suppose.
Maybe. But the real Bob, Bob Grayson, the Marvel Boy, all this time was in near suspended animation on Uranus, living as part of the native, like, collective unconscious in the membrane of the Uranians. Crazy. Anyway, when the team reaches Namora underwater in Antarctica, she is, in fact, a rotting corpse.
Ooh. Ooh.
But in issue 4, Bob realizes, you guys don't realize that this is a projection, right? it's an illusion, kind of like the ones I make. Here, let me turn it off. Snap. And, you know, she looks to just to be sleeping. So M11 uses this heat ray on her while these giant crustaceans attack. The team holds them off for a little bit, but eventually they're succumbing to them just out of sheer numbers, and they're calling out for M11's help, but he sticks with trying to revive Namora, and at the last minute, instead, it's a Namora who comes to the rescue.
All right.
I mean, I like all the characters, but I did kind of wonder if one of those weird sea creatures kills Gorilla Man, does he become a gorilla sea creature?
Yeah, right? So the team begins investigating Atlas's various business holdings, and they're all fronts for insidious operations that need to be put down, every one of them.
I feel like there's a lot of story in there. Like, say this is successful, each one of those different fronts is a different story.
I also wonder how many versions of Namor the Namor family uses. Like, like, are there just 20 Namorism and Namorat? And
now, one of these insidious operations was near the Fiji Islands, and they decide, hey, while we're here, let's take a day off. But while they're there recuperating, Jimmy Woo encounters the yellow, well, make that golden claw again.
Yeah, I know he did a little bit of reworking of some problematic elements to make him the golden claw, which works.
Yeah. They fight his golem-like clay warriors, and like always, the claw escapes. As issue 4 ends, Jimmy Woo tells Agent Kanata that one of his team is a double agent.
Dun dun dun.
In issue 5, Namora reveals that Venus is no goddess. In fact, she's a siren, cursed by a sorcerer to live as a partial human. And then Venus's, like, resulting sad song just freaks everybody out and sets them all against each other.
She really harshes their mellow, Steve.
That's for sure.
Woo reveals that M11 is the traitor, doing the bidding of the claw. And sure enough, when they open him up, he's got these Acme parts, or not Acme, Atlas parts inside.
I mean, he might have some of those parts too.
I would love if the Wile E. Coyote ordered M11 to kill the runner.
They all fight, but Jimmy Woo talks Venus's frown upside down, and then her song turns back to her good song, you know? And it makes the team all feel their greatest desires, which is depicted in a series of horizontal panels where you see Marvel Boy, like, naked in the membrane of the Uranians, which is pretty creepy. And you see Gorilla Man in the shadows with, like, a gorilla woman, and it's like, all right, well, like, whatever. But then you see Namora, like, making out with her cousin Namor, and I'm like, what the heck is with that? That's not right. And then Jimmy Woo is with Suwan, his secret love from years ago, which is a nice nod to the continuity, because Jimmy Woo, in chasing after the Yellow Claw, also had a thing for the Yellow Claw's daughter, who was Suwan.
It is weird how Hale has really gone native in a very, if he's no longer thinking of humans or anything, he's full Gorilla Man.
And see in that panel too that the gorilla has a little wedding ring on, the female gorilla.
Oh, that's right.
Kind of weird. On the cover of
they should have called him Jimmy Olsen instead of if he's going to go marry every gorilla he runs into.
or Superboy. I'm sure he married a gorilla or two. On the cover of Agents of Atlas number 6 of 6, the Earth in the Agents of Atlas logo is replaced by a golden claw. Probably not a good sign, right?
I wonder what that could mean.
This issue is framed with Agent Kanata giving his report afterwards to Dugan, but then revealing what really happened. Ooh, he lied. So what really happened? The fire that disintegrated Wu's first team was from a dragon, Mr. Lao.
Aw, yeah, that dragon.
And he's a pretty reasonable fellow. He's been an advisor to every Khan, Genghis included, right through to the Yellow Claw. And the Yellow Claw's name is Master Plan? That was kind of weird, too.
Well, I just hope Dr. Octopus doesn't find out he's coming dangerously close to his old alias.
Oh, yeah. Trademark infringement there.
So we find out that Wu is the successor to the suddenly very sweet Yellow Claw, or Golden Claw, or whatever you want to call him. And he agrees to the whole transition of power, so Mr. Lao eats the claw, and now Jimmy Wu is the new Khan.
Wild. Wild.
But he was also behind, like, the Gorilla Man. Oh, and everything. Like, he's a real puppet master dragon.
The creation of M11, sending Gorilla Man to Africa to become cursed. He's been behind it all. Yeah. I mean...
And he would have gotten away with it if it wasn't for those pesky kids.
I thought it was kind of weird that they basically Mandarinized Jimmy Wu, right? With the whole dragon and Khan thing. And Parker knows it, because they even mentioned the Mandarin, too. And Mr. Lao's like, oh, yeah, there are a lot of heirs to the Khans.
There's a lot of stuff in like, here what? That it's like, if he gets to do more stories, he's going to do more stuff.
All right, I'm going to have to read more then, right? Because there was more, because some of this, that and the, I mean, there was a couple of things where, I mean, you're right, this was fun comics, it was good comics, but there was a little bit too much continuity retooling for it to hit near the mark that they were trying to hit. Like, I wish they would have found a way to still do it and not change so many things, but yeah,
I think there's less of that historical continuity stuff later on. Like, there's just other weirdness. Like, I know we did that one appearance of them showing up in the Thunderbolts,
sure,
but that wasn't, like, I didn't think that was a fair representation of this book.
All right,
and they keep on trying, though. That's the funny thing. They kept on trying. Like, it's a cool collection of characters, but like not anything close to like an A-list like team of characters. So they're like, oh, well, we'll give them two series. We'll give them a one shot in like a Marvel Avengers kids book, and it's like, oh, we'll give them another mini series. We'll give them individual miniseries. Like, there's so many different things in different formats they tried, but I mean, none of them really ever really took off. I'm surprised we got as many different crazy things as we did.
There's a reason that by the end of the 50s and the early 60s, Marvel had given up on the superheroes and was doing monster comics and horror comics and, well, what passed for horror comics back then, mystery comics and westerns and that type of a thing, because yeah, these heroes didn't catch on even back then. But it's fun to go back and to, you know, make all these different nods to continuity. Like, it really stood out to me that this book was of the time in Marvel where they didn't put any references, you know, and like the editorial didn't give you any like, see this issue and see that issue, because there's a lot of connecting to other stuff throughout here.
I think,
and
that might have been in some of the online content.
Okay.
Like, because they were playing with some different stuff.
But in general, Marvel at this time wasn't doing a lot of that. A lot of the
footnotes,
the
yeah.
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 Wait, do I need to download that AR app that never works?
I think it's still on my phone.
Isn't this before the AR app?
Yes. This is before apps. This is early phones.
This might be right at the beginning of some stuff.
I think we still called it software and programs.
You still called it applications? Wait, is that the short form? App? Application?
Mind blown. All right, let's wrap up this episode of Marvel Noise. It's been a good summer. Let's get on to the fall and finishing up the march towards episode 400, which is also our 15th anniversary of this here podcast. Woohoo! All right, thanks, Kevin. Thanks, Andrew. Appreciate it. Until Mr. Lau tips the scales for good. See what I did there? Make mine Marvel.
Later.
Until Balls Out Avengers or whatever the hell the new thing is called.
I don't think that's family friendly.
He's a sulky, over-funky,
kind of hunky superhero.
Hot to piston and electrically transistored superhero. And exotically neurotic
and aquatic superhero.
The Marvel superheroes have arrived. Super-powered from the forehead to the toes. Watch them change their very shape before your nose. See, arcane striking superhero change to Viking superhero. Ahem, dingin' real, swingin' shield, clingin' superhero. They're the latest.